Colson Whitehead is one of America's most celebrated novelists, a two-time Pulitzer Prize winner whose fiction continually reinvents itself. His new novel, Cool Machine, returns to Harlem and the unforgettable Ray Carney for one final crime-filled adventure, exploring ambition, survival, and a city transformed during the turbulent 1980s. Colson Whitehead joins us next on The Book Show. Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Across Colson Whitehead's novels, including The Underground Railroad, The Nickel Boys, Harlem Shuffle, and Crook Manifesto, the two-time Pulitzer Prize winner has blended literary ambition with genre storytelling and an unmistakable sense of place. Now he brings his acclaimed Harlem trilogy to a close with Cool Machine, set in the fast-changing New York of the 1980s. The novel reunites readers with furniture dealer and reluctant fence, Ray Carney, as one last score draws him back into the city's criminal underworld. Against a backdrop of Reagan-era capitalism, real estate speculation, and a transforming Harlem, Whitehead delivers a deeply human portrait of a city and the people determined to survive it. It is a great pleasure to welcome Colson Whitehead to this week's book show. Colson, thank you very much for being with us. An honor to have you back.
Very good.
It's really wonderful to have you. I was a fan. The first book I read of yours, and I became an immediate fan, was Zero One. And I just thought, well, there is a book that is just stunning. And nothing that you have written really since then has been, as far as subject matter, really that close. And that really tells us a lot about your writing career, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, I do switch genres up a lot. Zone One was a zombie novel. I wrote a coming-of-age novel called Sag Harbor. Underground Railroad is a sort of fantastic historical novel. And now I'm doing this crime series. I think, like everyone else, you know, I like different kinds of stories. I like thrillers. I like dramas. I like science fiction. And the fun thing about my job is that I keep going and keep having new ideas. I can write these different genres that have inspired me and delighted me all these years.
I remember you saying at the time when we talked to you about Zero One that it was somewhat natural for you because you grew up on horror. You were a person within the Whitehead family. That was a genre that was very accepted.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you know, I remember in seventh grade, we got our first Betamax. It was like 1982. And my brother and I would go to the video store and rent, you know, five videos for the weekend. And it'd be classic horror like Dario Argento. It'd be John Carpenter. And then we'd throw in like Terms of Endearment or something. But yes, we were a horror-loving family. And, you know, reading Stephen King was really my introduction to reading sort of big books. I remember reading his collection, Night Shift,
yeah,
with the short stories. And then it was very daunting, so I would check the page numbers to see which one was the shortest story, like three pages, and I would go to the next longest story until finally I was reading, you know, the 40-page one.
Do you believe that he's somewhat, it's hard to say someone who is as famous as he is and as known as he is, that is often, I think, underrated for how great a writer he is.
Yeah, no, he's written definitely gory stories about vampires and werewolves, and also, you know, great novels and novellas that are realistic and, you know, so wholly realized and, you know, contain a lot of lovely writing. So he's done a lot of different things despite his, you know, main reputation as a horror writer.
What brought you to the crime genre? And I guess the crime genre in the sense of not only wanting to write the first book, but that it was going to be a trilogy.
Really just, you know, I talked about liking different kinds of stories. I love the heist genre, which is for me a film genre, not necessarily a novelistic genre. And I remember one day trying to think of what movie to watch. And I was like, Ocean's 11 again? How many times? kind of watch this movie. And just feeling jealous of Steven Soderbergh that he got to come up with a heist and these cool characters and, you know, these cool situations. So I was really just wanting to write a heist novel. And then I realized that I kept coming up with more and more stories. And so the novel became three different stories in one. And I'd written, I think, one half of the book, and I kept coming up with even more. So it became a trilogy. And I would just follow this guy over 30 years in the 60s and 70s and 80s. And each book contains three different capers or heists. So I was having a lot of fun with the world and coming up with more and more stories. So I just decided to let it rip.
As you said, Ray Carney, we know this man over 30 years at the completion of Cool Machine. And that is fascinating for us as readers to learn about the growth of this man, but for you, the growth of a character. And I'm curious as to what that is like of looking at it, especially in sort of a decade format.
Well, you know, if you commit to a kind of story or situation, you got to do it completely. So if I'm going to follow him over 30 years, who is he when he's 29 and who is he when he's 56? His kids are, you know, 1 year old, 2 years old in the first novel. And in the third novel, they've gone off to college and beyond, and he's an empty nester. So, you know, narrating the life of a person over 30 years, you have your ups and downs. And he definitely, as a reluctant fence, as you put it, is embracing and rejecting his criminal side over the course of three books until he comes to a final accommodation with it. So it means, like, if you're going to do it, you know, do it completely.
He is reluctant as a fence, but this is a character who we learn pretty early in the series who is constantly striving. He is continually striving.
He grew up poor. His father was a criminal, and that was a sort of model for manhood. But he rejects that, you know, in high school and college, and gets educated, opens up his furniture store. He's very proud of that. But there is part of him that says, you know, let's do some crimes. And in the final book, you know, there's a reckoning with what that means to be a criminal and want to and have this dark side. Why is he doing it 25 years later? Does he have to, or does it fulfill some sort of psychological need? So he's sort of circling all those different ideas.
Did you know that even from the beginning of what the answer was to that question of whether that was something that he needed to do financially or psychologically?
I think once I, you know, got to the end of Harlem Shuffle, the first book, I realized that before I could go on to the next book, I should probably plot out the second and third books and have an idea of the major movements, you know, not all the characters, not all the details, but where's he ending up? You know, is he alive at the end? Is he dead? Is he in a place of hope or despair? And so, so once I finished Harlem Shuffle, I was writing toward the final couple of pages of Cool Machine. And I think, you know, some people just make up their books as they go along. The muse like floats through the window and guides their fingers, but I'm definitely an outliner and I have to know where I'm taking these, what the final destination is. So, so I tried to figure out as much as I could before I started writing the second book.
But it also tells us, and I assume you have to know this, the character of the character in the sense of who this person is. And I think in Ray Carney, a very empathetic character.
Yeah, I mean, you're not going to follow someone for 1,100 pages if they're, a totally despicable criminal. So I think we can see ourselves, you know, in part of his, you know, part of his behavior. He is not a hardened criminal. He's fallen into this lifestyle and trying to figure out whether he wants to escape or stay in it. But hopefully if I'm doing my job right, you can see yourself in his shoes and root for him. You know, you want him to succeed and figure things out.
What do you see your job as being? You say, if I've done my job right, what do you see your job as being?
Job one is not write, don't write a crappy book. So I think people will say, like, does a novel have to be political? Does it have to be this or that? No, I think the novel just has to not be bad. And then I like to like to have characters who have weird jobs, you know, a fence, a elevator inspector and the intuitionist, a cleaner up of zombies in zone one. And if I, you know, choose these different characters, male, female, they do this, they do that, and make them real for the reader, then I've accomplished my goal. And also, if it's not bad, to go back to that, as long as it's not bad, I feel, you know, pretty good about things.
Who makes that distinction? You have said that the mission of an artist is not to make crappy art. So how do you do that, and how much of a challenge is that?
Well, you know, I've been doing it for 25 years, and I think I know when I've set out what I wanted to do, and I haven't slacked. I haven't, you know, been cheap with the characters. I've fulfilled my mission for me. Now, does that mean other people will agree? I can't control that, but I feel at this point, if I've fulfilled my ambitions for a work, there'll be some people who come along for the ride. They may hate zombies. They may hate crime fiction and only like, say, my, you know, nonfiction book about the world series of poker. So they might not come along for every book, but I think most artists think that if they nail the poem, nail the painting, nail the film, then other people will come along.
And that certainly has been the case in your career. But again, you go back to how eclectic it's been, which seems like a wonderful freedom that many authors feel that they have to write similarly to continue with that success. But you've avoided that.
Well, I think if you're doing the same thing over and over again, you're not challenging yourself, and definitely I would get bored. The Ray Carney stories, or, you know, 1,100 pages of one character, three books. I was not done with him, but definitely, if you're, I think, you know, going over the same territory over and over again, I would definitely get bored by that. And so, switching up genres, find different kinds of stories, different kinds of things, the challenging makes the work live for me.
So when it comes to Ray Carney, as you say, it's been 30 years, and in this novel we're looking at him in the 80s, and that's fascinating, especially in comparison to the earlier novels, because it's what a character goes through. It's what we all went through of living through the 80s, and just how disruptive and odd a decade that was, although we could probably say that about most decades.
Sure. I mean, I definitely want to capture a recognizable 80s. The 70s in New York City were a time of hardship. The city was bankrupt and crime was at an all-time high. So we're coming back to Ray's story in 1981. There's a new mayor, Ed Koch. There's a lot of development going on. Wall Street is coming back. So what does that mean, you know, in the life of a city to have these ups and downs? What does it mean for a businessman who depends on the economic health of the city and its customers? So I really do want to capture that, and also figure out different moments in New York City 80s history that I can use to illuminate his character and the other characters.
You think of the beginning of that decade, and as it progresses, of Reaganism and greed is good, and then by the end of that decade, the city dealing with the AIDS epidemic and still coming into yet another chapter.
Another recession and hard times, the rise of the AIDS crisis, the continued advance of the homeless problem, the crack epidemic. And so, you know, the book ends in 1986, and definitely it's before Black Monday, the crash in 87. But we know as readers and people who lived through that time that the city's going to go through another bad patch. So you, whenever you're up, there are definitely forces arrayed to bring you down again.
Tell me about the dedication of this particular novel.
There's an expletive, and it's a New York freaking city, I guess you could say. Yes, you know, I've written a few books, and I definitely have dedicated them to my friends and family. And I was running out of people to dedicate it to, so why not the city that is a main character in the book that has given me so much, and has really made me the person and writer I am? I keep coming back to New York City as a subject, as a locale. So it was time. I was It was time and perhaps overdue to leave the city.
You just said something. You sort of walked right into what I wanted to talk to you about, which is this idea of the city being a character. How do you feel about that notion? We hear it in fiction a lot of the city being a character, going back to Ulysses and Joyce. So, what is it? How do you feel about that? Because it is about the city, but also it shows the many facets of a huge, sprawling place.
It has. It's always annoyed me. I've always found a kind of a lazy formulation. But halfway through Harlem Shuffle, I was like, "Damn, dag nabbit!" The city is a character, and so I sort of had to lean into it. It was happening anyway. But if you're narrating the life of the city, then you're trying to figure out how it works over 30 years, in the same way I'm trying to figure out how Ray Carney works over 30 years, and so. Despite my reticence, I had to lean into it. I had no choice.
The name of the new novel is Cool Machine, and it is the third volume in Colson Whitehead's trilogy. You talk about the churn. Explain that, because that is a churn that takes place throughout this trilogy.
Yeah, and it means something different in different decades, and means something different depending on how old and Ray Carney is. But it's the constant destruction, reinvention, dynamism of the city. Harlem Shuffle opens up downtown New York, a place called Radio Row, a big den of radio and TV hobbyists in the 40s and 50s. That neighborhood is completely razed and destroyed to put the World Trade Center up. We come back in the third volume, Cool Machine, and Ray and his wife are having a celebration dinner at the top of the World Trade Center, Windows on the World. There's a restaurant there. And so we've seen, just one example of churn, this neighborhood in New York City, rise up, fall down, rise up. And then, of course, from our vantage, we know that there's another fall coming. So Ray is constantly being tested and has to reinvent himself the same way that all these different neighborhoods, Harlem, downtown, the only constant is change.
With that change, I mean, this is change that you yourself have gone through and in the city that you write about.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a lifelong New Yorker. I think the problem or challenge for this book is that, I haven't lived in Harlem since I was in kindergarten. So I had to rediscover it and figure out what would work for the novel, what blocks, what incidents in Harlem history. And it was fun research, just wandering down this avenue, across the street, up this avenue, trying to figure out where Ray's office is. Is that building depressing enough for it to be his childhood home? Where do you dump a body? I did a lot of where to dump a body rumination. And it was fun to, just rediscover, this a part of a city I didn't know that well.
So, which brings, I guess, sort of the opposite way that I would have asked this, but so what brought you to Harlem?
Really, just a set of, concrete problems. What's the next book? Okay, a heist novel. I want to set it in New York because I wrote the Underground Railroad and the Nickel Boys. That didn't take place in New York. And I didn't want to do a lot of research into a different land. I didn't want it to be too far into the past because I didn't feel like writing another deeply historical novel. And then where's it going to take place? It's a black crime novel. It's New York City. It's either Harlem or Brooklyn. And there's more research available about Harlem than there is about black Brooklyn. So there you go. It was just a series of what do I feel up for at the time?
You talked earlier in our conversation about the idea of having these heists within the novels, and what makes a good heist scene?
There's the tension and also, the possibility of it going wrong or right. I think heist narratives, you can either, as in Ocean's 11, plot and plan and pull it off and get your jackpot, your big cash payday. Or there's the more existential conclusion where you can plot and plan and try to change your life, try and get that big score, outwit your destiny, outwit fate. But of course, everything goes wrong, and the wheel man is drinking again. The guy's going to crack the safe. He's arguing with his wife and he's distracted. And so for all your plotting and planning, everything goes south. And that's what I like about the genre is that there's this potentiality for, a triumphant win or the horrible despair of being trapped in who you are and your circumstances.
There's a line early on in the novel, and I didn't mark it, but I think in the first 50 pages or so, where you write that Carney ducked, he never liked the gun stuff. That struck me. It tells us a lot about this man and his commitment to a heist.
Yeah, I mean, usually he's on, he comes in after the heist. A fence is someone who takes the stolen jewelry,
Right.
the stolen watches, washes it, launders it, and recirculates it back into polite society. But so the fence comes in, usually comes in after the heist. And in this one, the final story, he joins a heist directly for the first time, and he's there for some of the planning and for the execution. So that's part of the test of who he is now in his mid-50s. He's doing something he's avoided, never participated in. He's never, never holds a gun for very long, and definitely never shoots it. And now he's involved in a heist in a very real sort of way when he's been very distant from it.
Were you fascinated even from the beginning of how he would react to that, of being put in that position?
I like that his character, came fairly quickly. I did research into fences, and a lot of fences in real life will have a legitimate storefront where they sell electronics or furniture, and in the back is where they do their illicit business. And to me, that spoke to a divided nature. And so having that split early on was very helpful in figuring him out. He'll join a heist. He's not going to be violent. Definitely not going to be any shooting on his part. So what does that mean? How deep is he into the criminal world? Is his heart in it? We're exploring all these different things.
What is it about him that makes him a good fence?
He's a good salesman, and he understands facts and figures and people. I think he has to have that sense of who people are when they walk into the store. Is he going to steer them to the cheap stuff, the more expensive stuff? How much are they willing to spend? How much can he push? And I think he uses that psychology to deal with all the criminal types he comes into contact with. That savviness, that sense of people helps him, whether it's just in fencing or getting him out of a scrape, a situation that his fencing life has gotten him into.
You talk about of how he deals with other people. It's one of the things I love about these novels. There are a lot of characters. There's a lot of people coming in and out of these books.
Yeah, I mean, each book has three capers, so that's nine stories over the course of them. And the story is always resetting. There's a new situation, a new heist, new people who are getting robbed or hoodwinked or conned or killed. And so there's always new people coming in. And then there are the main characters who are in all three books, like Pepper. There's a film producer named Zippo who appears in different guises in the three books. And one of the wonderful things was having a world and then populating it and following people over time. And so, who is Zippo in 1959 compared to 1983? Who's Pepper? Pepper is, Ray Carney's sidekick, friend, associate, criminal associate, the muscle. He's like a sociopathic individual. How does he grow over 30 years? So it's not just, Carney, it's his wife and his kids and a lot of the criminals as well. And that was just a really great world to be in.
The story arc of Ray's wife in this novel is a fascinating one.
She starts off working for a travel agency, helping black travelers find lodging and restaurants that are safe in the South, the Jim Crow South, a Green Book type of situation,
Right.
if you're familiar with that. She leaves to start her own business, and being a female entrepreneur in the 70s and early 80s doesn't have it so easy. And so we have someone who's a feminist, a business person. How does she fare in, those 30 years? Where is she going, and what is she trying to attain? So again, committing to the bit, as I was saying earlier, if you're gonna enter this world, it has to be fully fleshed out. And I definitely didn't want his wife, Elizabeth, to be a simple periphery character. I wanted her to have a full life.
And Ray wants to help.
He wants to be a good husband and then a good partner, and he knows how tough it is to start your own business. So he's eager to help his wife out.
Do you see at the end of a trilogy, how does that weave Colson Whitehead feeling? I mean, obviously you will continue to write, you will write other books, I assume in other genres. But what is it like to weave something that you have spent a good amount of time, and as you say, over 1,100 pages of how you feel about that?
I'm glad that it's finally out this week, and people can get their hands on it. I think there's stuff in the first two books that finally comes to fruition in the third books. I had an idea of a sort of a large design, and now it's finally done. So I'm psyched for people to finally know what I was up to, and I'm also eager, to start something else. I know who Ray is. I know how he reacts when I poke him with different plot elements, different situations, and I'm eager to find that again with another set of characters in a different story.
That's just what I was going to ask you. So there's an eagerness to create a character that you're as invested in, maybe not over a trilogy, but as invested in as you have been in Ray.
10 or 11 novels I've written, and definitely everyone is vivid and real and important when I'm writing the book. Then I finish it and I start over again, and that's kind of annoying, but also my job. That's my job too. So
It's what a writer does. It's what a storyteller does. It's what an artist does.
so enjoy that you did what you set out to do, and then start from scratch again.
And do you enjoy this process? Maybe not so much of talking about the book, but of seeing it go out into the world, doing events, talking to readers, hearing from readers.
Yeah, I mean, I feel I'm very lucky, and definitely when I do a bookstore event at night, I realize the sacrifice people are making after a long day of work, and they have a lot on their plate, and they'll come to a bookstore or come to a lecture hall, and they're curious about the book. I think in this case, I've met people who have picked up the first book and the second book, and they've been asking when the third one's coming out, and so it's a different thing when it's a series, because I'm lucky that people liked Ray and liked his earlier adventures, and they want to see how it ends up. So that's really delightful, and I'm glad that I can go out and talk to readers and see folks as I support the book.
The brand new novel, the third in the trilogy, is Cool Machine, a novel by Colson Whitehead. Colson, thank you so much for spending time with us. Best of luck with the new book.
Yeah, thanks a lot. I'll see you soon.
Colson Whitehead is the author of the new novel Cool Machine, published by Doubleday. Thanks to our producer, Madeline Reynolds. Write to us at book@wamc.org. The latest on National Productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter at wamc.org and on social media at WAMC Radio. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.